Detective or mystery stories often involve the solution of crimes through the meticulous sifting of details involving the time the crime was committed and the circumstances surrounding it. And numbers lie at the heart of the process of such careful detection. As John Irwin has remarked, the archetypal pattern of the detective genre was established by the ancient Greeks with Oedipus, whose search for the murderer of the king is represented as a numerical mystery built upon the four numbers of the tetrad. The one who solved the Sphinx's numerical riddle about the identity of a creature who speaks with one voice and walks on 2, 3, and 4 feet also solves the numerical mystery of the identity of the killer of the king, the mystery of a single man named Oedipus who discovers that he has a dual identity by recognizing himself in Jocasta's account as the same person who, at a spot where 3 roads meet, slew 4 men. The solution to the Oedipal mystery involves the recognition of the essential doubleness of human nature as personified by Oedipus, who is both detective and killer. Agatha Christie wrote mystery stories in which the detective, along with the reader, must sort through a maze of such details to arrive at the solution to the crime. Now, we certainly do not want to give anything away, but just a tip. Christie uses the numbers 8 and 0 and the letter O to signify death in some of her works. In her numerical system, 8 counts as a double 0, one on top of the other, signifying the nothingness of death. These letters and numbers occur in repeated patterns, which provide the attentive reader with an awareness of the pervasiveness of death in various guises, create a game ambiance as we trace their reappearances in many ways, and finally establish a sense of overriding order and destiny. The patterns are repeated too often and insistently to be coincidental. The methods she uses to insinuate these letters and numbers are proof that Christie intends them to be an integral part of her narratives, which provide a counterpointing between form and content, and furnish the reader with the aesthetic delight of detecting her ingenuity. Take the novel 10 Little Indians, also titled And Then There Were None, for example. In both the novel and the play versions, the 8 guests arrive on August 8th. August is the 8th month, and on its 8th day, we have 8 people arriving. Dinner on the first evening is set for 8, and the boatman is expected to return the next morning shortly before 8 with 8 pints of milk. Further, 8 of the characters have O's in their last names. And that's just the beginning. All that from an essay on deceptive and deadly numbers in Agatha Christie by Frank Ardolino in the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology, August 2001. We are invited to test our wits and sit at the edge of our seats as the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts in Hazleton presents And There Were None, And Then There Were None, this weekend and next. Adam Randis is the director, and Jessica Schaefer has the role of Vera, and they paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the play.
This time around, we are doing Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, which had a couple of other titles in the past. 10 Little Indians is the most popular, but this is widely acknowledged as Agatha Christie's masterpiece, and she acknowledged that herself. She said it was the best plotting she has ever done in anything that she had ever written, and it is actually, I just saw the statistic the other day, it is the 3rd highest-selling book of all time, believe it or not.
The idea that we have to talk about a mystery without tipping your hand so that we will be surprised. So how do you talk about it without spoiling it?
Well, there's certainly some tiptoeing involved. We were discussing that on the car ride up here, actually. What you can say, what you can't say. But I think we can do some place setting with it. And especially because this particular piece is so influential, a lot of what it did very originally in the first place has now kind of become standard for a lot of mysteries that have come afterwards. So anybody who's seen anything mystery related will know essentially the early story beats of this.
What year are we talking? I don't mean when is it set, but when did she write this?
Well, both are the same, actually. It was written in 1939, right as England was heading inexorably into World War II. And she wrote it throughout 1939. It was published in November after war was already declared. And then later on, she adapted her own novel into a stage play in 1943. And I think what you really see in this is that the historical and the cultural context weigh very heavily on And Then There Were None in so many different ways. If you look at this, this idea of there's a permeating feeling of nihilism in the characters and in the story. Agatha Christie, this is the first time that she doesn't have a moral center character to kind of lead you through the mystery. There's no Hercule Poirot here. There's no Miss Marple. There is no person who the audience sides with and says, okay, this person is on our side. Instead, what she sets up is what has now become rather a trope in mysteries. 10 strangers invited to a secluded place who don't know each other. When they get there, they realize that they'd been invited under false pretenses. They have no way out. And then they start dying. Throughout, it's established that there's no way anybody else could get in or out, so it has to be one of those people. And this is where they begin to divide up and try to form alliances and figure out who is who and double-cross each other as we just move chugging forward as more and more bodies pile up to see who the actual killer is.
That was quite something for that time then.
It was groundbreaking for the time. Now, today, you've seen this in so many different things. I mean, it's the inspiration for the board game Clue. They made a musical about it called Something's Afoot. There was so many different satires and parodies of it, like the Neil Simon movie Murder by Death. And episodes of Family Guy and other television shows have taken this idea of like people who are locked in a secluded place and someone's done something horribly wrong, oftentimes to comic effect, but also there have been many adaptations of this particular story. There's been adaptations in Britain, there are multiple films, there's a Russian film based on it, so at the time, it was groundbreaking, and it's really kind of become timeless because it plays a lot on the fears that people have of various things, of not being able to escape, of having your freedom or your independence taken away from you, but also the fear that what you've done in the past will come back to haunt you. The fear that, or not even the fear, but the idea that people who think they are good become exposed to the faults or the flaws within them, and they literally have to face their flaws as they're facing death. And that's where this is the most psychologically complex of Agatha Christie's works, because you don't have that person who you can say, okay, there's the good guy, there's the guy or the woman who wears the white hat, who will solve the mystery, who will help us, the viewer or the reader or the listener. Instead, you have these people who are all flawed individuals, who are literally brought together by some sort of a mastermind because they are bad people. And that also kind of has this feeling of the times in the 1920s and 1930s after World War I, where Britain was war-torn. The psychological and emotional scars of World War I are still very fresh, while it seems like everything is barreling into World War II, this idea that we've done something wrong, or there's something within our society or within ourselves, within human DNA, that creates this situation where world wars just seem to keep rolling on each other. And so all of that is tied into this. Now, it's not necessarily right there at the level of text in the original novel or even in the play, but it's certainly there as subtext. This idea of judgment, of people being judged for who they are and what they are underneath the surface.
Had you read this, Jess? Had you known this before you got involved in the production?
This was my first exposure to the story, and I did read it just after I got the part. And I'm really excited for it because I've not done anything quite this dramatic before. This is only my third play, too. I'm more versed in musicals. So there's some really meaty material for me to be able to tackle in this as an actress.
And do we find, because it's plot-driven in a certain sense, are these three-dimensional characters, or do they serve the plot more?
In this story, you have some very well-rounded characters. And not to speak poorly of the dame, but Agatha Christie has often been known to have certain characters who only fulfill a certain position in the story or plot-wise or as a character type, and then that's what they do. When they come to the island thinking it's going to be a retreat or it's going to be a vacation or a holiday, as they would say, they present themselves as just regular people, good people, folks who would be able to pal around for a weekend. And so you see, I think, in the beginning, the outward appearance that kind of we all put on. We all put on a character, we all put on a show for people to see, a character that we want people to think we are. But then when their previous crimes for which they had not received proper judgment come to light, that's when you begin to peel back the onion. That's when you begin to see that these people have multiple layers. And now there are some characters in the play who are not necessarily sympathetic. There's an old spinster who took a young girl in as her maid of all work and then threw her out of the house once she found out she was pregnant out of wedlock and refused to let her back in. The girl was so sad that she committed suicide by drowning. And that woman, Emily Brent, the spinster, does not believe that she did anything wrong. She has a puritanical religious conviction that everything that she does is right because she does it according to the dictates of her own conscience, which is guided by God. And so for her, she's kind of a one-dimensional figure, but a fascinating one-dimensional figure in that. Another character is a young, rich, snobby, probably Etonian boy, silver spoon in his mouth from birth, Anthony Marsden, who his crime was he ran over two children in his car because he was speeding. And the only thing he got was a slap on the wrist because he was rich and his family was connected. Now, these days, we would call that affluenza. They didn't want to punish him because he was so rich and so ignorant that he didn't realize what he was doing was wrong. And in that character, you don't really find a lot to like. But then there are other characters in the show who are very multidimensional, one of which is Vera Claythorne, who is played by Jess.
How have you gotten to know Vera? What are you finding about her?
Well, as I said, I started with the book, and I also watched the BBC movie, which I think came out around 2015. And I felt they did a really great job in that of fleshing out the characters, and the dialogue was very smart in that version. So that's kind of where I started, and I'm finding that, as Adam was saying, you find sympathy in these characters. For instance, Vera speaks to different characters throughout the play about the crimes that they've committed or that they're being accused of committing. And she's questioning them about what they did or why they did it. But there's more to it than that. It's more than her just wanting to know what they did. It's helping her to figure out, is she guilty, and to deal with the guilt that she is feeling over this act that she's being accused of committing.
There's a great facet to Vera. She's a nursery governess. She would basically be the person who would be in charge of watching, perhaps teaching, being a nanny, being a caregiver for a young rich child. And something happened to the boy that was in her care before she comes to the island. So she comes in and she's young and she's beautiful and she knows it and she's flirty and she's nice and people are drawn to her. Kind of everyone in the cast is drawn to her as a character. But she's holding this guilt inside of her. It peeks out at key moments even before it becomes clear that this whole arrangement for that weekend was a charade to expose these people's inner demons. So she plays that very well, and that's an example of a very well-rounded character. Another thing that comes to mind when Jess was bringing that up is this idea that Vera, as a character, can kind of serve for a while as an audience cipher. She sits down, and it's almost like the other characters want to tell her about their pasts and what they did, and either explain it away or find perhaps some form of forgiveness or understanding in her. And in that, we also see this idea that Agatha Christie plays with this idea of people taking on different roles. And sometimes those roles can change even within the show. Because there's no Hercule Poirot, because there's no Sherlock Holmes figure, at various points, different characters kind of put on the deerstalker cap, and they play the detective. and they kind of take center stage leading the activities. And then that person will either die or be pushed in the background and somebody else rises up to take charge. So we see a lot of that, this idea that people can put on these different personality traits as the situation dictates or as they want to dictate to the situation.
In terms of the isolation and the inability to escape, is this a pressure cooker? Do you want to create a sense that we're really all, including the audience, in this smothering environment?
Absolutely. When they first come onto the island, it's bright and sunshiny. The seagulls are squawking and the songbirds are singing. You think, oh, look at this. It's bright. It's open. It's an island just off the coast of Devon in England, and they're all there for a nice holiday. But as soon as it turns out that the boat that goes back and forth between that island and the mainland doesn't show up, there's no telephone on the island, it has a generator that runs out of power, obviously, as is wont to happen in these stories, a storm hits, then that island that looked so open and restful and peaceful becomes, like you just said, a pressure cooker. It becomes a claustrophobic environment that these people cannot escape from. And I don't know, Jess, how do you feel about that? How do you feel character-wise about the island and how that plays a part?
Definitely. My character shows up and she's just so excited to be on this vacation. She's commenting about how the smell of the sea and the gulls and the beach and the house is so lovely, and she's so excited about it. And you just see gradually through each scene that passes, by the end, it just becomes a nightmare for her.
It reminds me of what they say about Jean-Paul Sartre and his play No Exit, and that hell is other people. There's a measure of that, but you're also telling us that it's also ourselves.
Mm, yes, right? Very true. And the island itself kind of takes on that setting from being a retreat to being hell. One of the characters even remarks later on in the play, are we in hell? Are we being judged? Are we already dead? So that idea of judgment and hell and fiery inferno, it's right there on that island as well. And that adds to that feeling of tension and the feeling of paranoia that's just seeping under the surface from the very beginning, but then boils over. The tension really builds in this very, very well as you start whittling the people down. And that's another interesting aspect of it, is that all of these murders that are taking place amongst these 10 people use the framing device of an old nursery rhyme, which in our version is 10 Little Soldier Boys. And it does come from a song that was done in minstrel shows in America in the 1860s, 10 Little Indians. And like we often see in nursery rhymes, things that are for children can oftentimes be scary. They can be gruesome. And in the 10 Little Indians story, horrible things happen to these people and they get whittled down. Now, Agatha Christie did a little bit of modifying for her own purposes in the verses. 10 little Indians going out to dine, one choked himself, and then there were nine, is how it starts. So you have something like that, and you see, well, who is this person that's behind this judgment? There's an infantile nature to it, almost, a juvenility to it, about exacting this judgment. What you would think for an adult would be such an odd way. It's very, as I said before, it's a very juvenile thing, and it belies perhaps that whoever is behind this has some serious developmental issues of their own.
And Jess, you were a nanny, so you are connected with children, and you're young yourself. Do you, as a character, relate to the nursery rhymes because of what you do in your nursery world of your life?
That's an interesting question, and I think Vera is the one who is so fascinated with this rhyme. She's the one who first notices it and announces it to everyone, and is throughout the play is always reciting it and going back to it and figuring it out. She's the real detective of the rhyme, I feel, throughout the whole piece.
From what you say, it doesn't sound at all like this is a period piece that could be dated.
Sure. And as you can see with just the idea of these story beats being repeated and repeated in all sorts of different media, whether it be radio or television or film continuously, there's something resonant about this story. And I think it comes back to that idea that even though it is a board game, you know, it is chess pieces, it is clue pieces, it is Colonel Mustard in the kitchen with the rope. At the same time, it's also these people, and it's also this idea of judgment, and it's the ideas of who we are internally, who we present to the rest of the world, and also where we feel that we have come up short, and how oftentimes we try to hide that. And people have an innate fear of whatever we don't want becoming public coming out, that our secrets will be revealed. And that's where we see the staying power in this, this idea of bringing someone's latent or pushed back or obfuscated guilt right to the surface for everyone to see. And how do you react when you're in that sort of situation? No, 1939, 2017, it doesn't matter. That still resonates.
We're watching on a national scale this question of, do they have anything to hide? And if they do, what is it? Now, what are the challenges of directing a piece like this?
There are a couple of challenges for a director in this. It's nice that Agatha Christie, in writing this play, sets it all in one room, a giant living room in a mansion. So we don't have to necessarily worry about intricate set changes or moving set pieces around. But there's also 10 people on stage, oftentimes all at the same time. And so you have to make sure that those people can be seen and can be heard. And how they interact with each other is very important, because you want the actors who should be focus to have the audience's focus. But at the same time, you don't want the other 8 or 9 people on stage to not still be in character and still be doing things. So we talk a little bit about a couple of key things with this show, such as who's supposed to have the focus when, what you should be doing when you are not the focus, and a lot of that comes with people's position on stage, whether or not their faces are obscured. But also this idea that this is a play in which there's a lot of exposition. This is a play in which there are a lot of pronouncements that sometimes take the form of almost a soliloquy. And how do you keep the audience engaged? Pacing is so important. Picking up right where the other person left off, acting not in between your lines, but acting while you say something. And for some actors, and especially in things like musicals, where you have a specific place and a time to be, it's okay, I hit my spot and I do what I'm supposed to do. With this show, it hasn't been a challenge, because I have an extremely talented group of actors. They picked up on it very quickly, is this idea that you should be walking and talking. You should be doing things while you're delivering your dialogue. You have to multitask, which is difficult. It's difficult because in our everyday lives we do it, but when you're on stage, you have that self-conscious idea of, well, how does this look if I'm smoking a cigarette while I'm supposed to be walking, or saying something while I'm supposed to be pouring a cup of coffee? And so things that we would do in our everyday lives and not think about it twice, when you're on stage, you have a sort of hyper-reality of wanting to see, oh, am I pouring this coffee all right? Does it look fake if I talk while I pour my coffee? But it's something, because it's a show that originally was written in 3 acts, it's a show that has multiple scenes, you have to keep it moving, and you have to keep the audience engaged while you keep it moving. And I have a group of people who are all seasoned actors who have been doing this for a very long time, and it's very nice as a director to be able to sit back and trust that they will be able to figure out how to get where they're supposed to go. They'll be able to figure out when to move out of the way for somebody else to take center stage or to take the focus of the audience. And they've been very, very good about that.
Do you use extra sound? Do you use any incidental music? Do you use seagulls?
Yes, as director, I'm wearing multiple hats with this one, in that I'm also the sound engineer. So I've been working over the past week to sequence the incidental music and to have the sound of rain and the thunder cracks when lightning happens. And we added a very brief prologue to the beginning of the show, too. We gave a voice to the young boy who was in Vera's care before the tragedy happened to him. And so we have that kind of as a little place setting for it. So I had to record that, and we had to add the sounds of the beach behind his short conversation with Vera and that sort of stuff to add a more immersive effect to it. And I'm blessed with the great help of a very good friend of mine, actor and director for many years in the central Pennsylvania region, Bob Taylor, who is doing my set for me. He's a wonderful set builder. And I have a very good technical director in Joel Payton, who is also the building manager of the PTPA, who's done my lights and my sound. It looks really good. There are moments where people are only illuminated supposedly by candlelight, but when you have fake LED candles, that doesn't really work. So we have some ambiance lighting at one point when the generator goes down, and it looks really spooky. It looks really neat.
Now, where do we find you and when?
Okay, the show opens this weekend at the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts, which is at the J.J. Ferrara Center in downtown Hazleton. It's at 212 West Broad Street. To order tickets, you can call 570-454-5451, or you can go to the website ptpashows.org. and they have the ability to order tickets online as well. If you want to come to the dinners, the PTPA is rather famous for the dinners cooked by Sue Childs and her crack cooking staff. It's a wonderful, wonderful dinner available for this show with a little mix of continental flavor and a bit of the food from England as well. You would arrive at 5:30. Shows are at 7, and so an hour and a half earlier if you're coming on Fridays or Saturdays. So it runs this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The Friday and Saturday shows are at 7. The Sunday show is at 3.
Director Adam Randis and Jessica Schaefer, who has the role of Vera, in the stage version of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie, opening tonight at the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts, 212 West Broad Street in Hazleton in the J.J. Ferrara Center. The production runs this weekend and next, Fridays and Saturdays at 7, Sundays at 3. There is a dinner option. Those dates, June 16th and 17th, and again the 23rd and 24th, Fridays and Saturdays at 7, and then Sunday matinees at 3, June 18th and the 25th. For more information on the web, ptpashows.org, ptpashows.org. That's Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, presented by the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts, 212 West Broad Street in Hazleton.